Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zach Elwood. This is a podcast about understanding human behavior. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. I don't make any money on this podcast and spend a good amount of time on it. So if you like it, I very much appreciate a rating on iTunes or shares on social media. Or if you're a poker player, you can check out my Poker Tells books or videos and buy those, and that'll be win-win for everybody. Today, I'll be interviewing professional poker player Dara O'Kearney. We'll be talking about poker tells, aka behavioral patterns in poker. I'll ask him questions like, how useful does he find poker tells? How has he made use of them? How have his thoughts on poker tells changed over his career? We'll also just talk about poker in general, and even if you're not that interested in tells or poker, you may find it interesting to get a glimpse of the poker world and the poker lingo and how serious poker players think about things. Dara has been playing poker professionally for 15 years or so and is well known in the poker world. He's an ambassador for Unibet Poker, Cards Chat, and Share My Pair. He's the author of two books, Poker Satellite Strategy and PKO Poker Strategy, and also a forthcoming book on ICM, which stands for Independent Chip Model, which is a mathematical model used to calculate a player's overall equity in tournaments in specific situations. He might be most well-known in the poker world for his podcast, The Chip Race, which he co-hosts with David Lappin. And if you're interested, I've appeared on their podcast a couple times. To the best of my knowledge, The Chip Race is the most popular poker podcast out there. Dara is also known for long-distance running. He was Irish National 24-hour champion, and he won the New York Ultra Marathon. You can find Dara on Twitter at Dara O'Kearney, that's D-A-R-A. O-K-E-A-R-N-E-Y. And you can find the Chip Race podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you didn't know, I myself am pretty well known in the poker world for my work on poker tells. It's my main claim to fame in general. It's definitely not for this podcast. Not to toot my own horn too much, but many people, both experienced players and amateur players, have called my books and videos the best work out there on the subject. I have three books, Reading Poker Tells, Verbal Poker Tells, and Exploiting Poker Tells. And I have a video series, which is currently at more than 12 hours of content right now. You can learn more about all of that and see reviews and testimonials at readingpokertells.com. I've also been hired by several well-known poker players to analyze behavior for them. I was hired by two World Series of Poker main event final tableists, Max Steinberg and Amir Lahavit. And I look for tells they and their opponents might have when they were playing for millions of dollars at the final table of those events. I've done other video analysis work for some other high-stakes players, and I've written pieces for various Poker World publications, including the old out-of-print Bluff Magazine, Upswing Poker, Poker News, and more. Dara and I's conversation covers a lot of ground, and it can be hard to talk about poker tells, or poker in general, as it's such a complex topic. So I thought it'd be helpful to give a quick overview of the relative importance of poker tells. First, it's important to understand that you can be a hugely winning poker player without ever even thinking about poker tells. Poker strategy, whether that's a very strong game theory fundamental strategy or the more exploitative strategic adjustments, is just so much more important than poker tells. Poker tells have been described as the icing on the cake, and I think that's a good analogy. Most experienced players I've talked to agree with my view that being strong at reading poker tells will typically add somewhere between 1 and 15% to a poker player's win rate. It's possible that that could be significantly higher if someone were, say, playing very weak and tell-filled competition, or if they were very, very good at reading people but pretty bad at strategy, or if they were in a huge tournament spot and a single tell would give them a big payoff. But I think for most serious players who also excel at tells, it's somewhere in that 10 to 15% boost to their win rate over the long term. And it's maybe worth saying that the main reason more amateur and recreational players have found my books and videos helpful is not so much for reading other players, but for eliminating their own more obvious tells and plugging those leaks to ensure they're not being exploited in those ways by better players. Okay, that's probably enough of a general introduction about poker and poker tells. Here's the interview with Dara O'Kearney. Hi, Dara. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Zach. Great to talk to you again. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. So let's start with, you've been in the poker world for a good chunk of time, and I'm curious if you can describe how your view of poker tells, poker behavior, and how important they are has changed over time.
I've been in poker now for 14 years. I came into the game pretty late, it has to be said. I learned the game when I was 42. but I was full-time professional within a year and have been professional ever since. When I came in initially, I was an online player. So I just played online for the first bit, but I quickly started dabbling my feet in live poker. So I was, when I started in live, I was very inexperienced. And I think like most newcomers, I would say that I overestimated the importance of tells. Particularly when people look from the outside at poker, there's two things that they completely overestimate. One is tells and the other one is bluffing. They think everything is about bluffing. Mm-hmm. And as you get more and more experience, you kind of realize that, well, both of those things obviously do have their place. They're not as important as people think. Mm-hmm. So I think I instinctively read people reasonably well. Because when I started playing live, I certainly picked some stuff up. I also think I did the other side of it as well, hiding my own tells, not giving off that sort of information. But I did that by basically, I used to wear sunglasses at the table. I used to always dress the same. I wore a business suit, basically, and I just tried to standardize everything. But one story that jumps to mind about how people probably do overestimate tells is the very first tournament I actually played was in a small local casino here in Dublin, and I got heads up against a very experienced lady, probably Ireland's top female player at the time. And she actually had a blog, so I got the pleasure of reading her experience or her view of me afterwards. Mm. And she described me as a nervous newcomer, which was definitely accurate. And she said she found it very easy to read me, which I did not find accurate, because in the heads up, she got it in with 4% equity, having stared at me for a long time. So
she's saving face a little bit.
Yeah, I remember reading that chuckling, thinking, well, if you're able to read me that well, why did you get it in drawing almost dead?
Yeah.
And but there was a lot of bravado back then, I think, around where people claimed that they could soul read you just by looking at you. And it's a good strategy to have, because if somebody is nervous and you tell them that you can read them perfectly,
for sure,
then they might give off more information.
Yeah, it's intimidating for newer players. Yeah, I mean, I think it happens in a lot of sports where it's just the bravado of acting like your edge is so much greater than what you see. You know, it's, yeah.
Yeah.
Carry on though.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Then over time, I just kind of, so that was kind of an early indicator to me that, you know, maybe there was a bit of snake oil about people's claims that they could read people perfectly. Mm-hmm. I read some of the literature that was out there and wasn't particularly impressed by it. And then I read your books and I was extremely impressed by those. That was probably actually a sort of a tipping point for me, because I've kind of come around to not quite the online player's perspective of it's all nonsense. Mm-hmm. There is something to it, but it's not as big a deal as most people think. But then I read your books and they really resonated with me, and I did actually start picking up stuff. I would say, winding all the way forward now, or at least now when there used to be live poker pre-pandemic, I had kind of reached a stage where I definitely felt there was something to be gained from tells. But, you know, it might be just once a day that you pick up mm-hmm. a very strong read mm-hmm. on somebody.
Especially if you're playing in tougher games. Yeah,
and that's the other point I wanted to make. It really depends on who you're playing against. If you're playing, you know, a high roller, it's very, very unlikely you're going to pick up anything. Even the recreations that play that tend to be pretty good at hiding their tells. But if you're playing a lower buy-in, you'll see a lot of it. It can be almost overwhelming. So it really does depend on sort of the level of the players as well. The other aspect for me these days is I coach a lot of online players, and then when they decide to play live, they come to me, and they're usually more focused on trying to hide anything that they're afraid they might give off themselves. I can usually reassure them on that stuff, because I genuinely believe that most players out there just aren't very good at picking up tells.
Yeah, it's not nearly as big a problem as people might think. Yeah,
exactly. And I just tell them, you know, just try and standardize everything. Always move the chips into the pot the same way. If you're going to verbalize, always use the same words. Don't sometimes speak, sometimes not speak, all that stuff. And you'll be fine. But then on the other side, there are still some reasonably common tells that I see others give up. But again, it's really sort of just at the lower buy-in levels that you tend to see this much.
Yeah, I think you've given a good rundown of how your views of tells change over time. There definitely is that overestimation of their importance, especially for people who don't play poker or people who just start out playing poker. There's that sexy element of like, oh, it's all about bluffing. It's all about reading tells, you know. And then you, like a lot of things, you get into it and you realize what the most important things are. And yeah, like you said, I always tell people, I emphasize in my books, you know, tells are a pretty small part of poker, like I'd say very small in general, especially if you're playing tough opposition. It's like 90% of the game plus is strategy. And there's just so much to strategy, and having that more realistic view of tells that, you know, it's something that might change a decision, you know, a few times in an 8-hour session or something, you know, and the higher stakes you play, the less that's going to be a factor. And then the other thing is that often tells just reinforce what you were already going to do. Like, it doesn't, you know, if you read someone for having a strong hand and you already were going to respect their bet, you know, that happens a lot. So you might see a lot of tells through a session, but it might only change your decision, like, you know, a very small percentage of the time. And that's the other big factor there.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And coming back to the idea that people exhibited more at lower stakes, one exception to that is when the stakes are higher than people are used to, then they get a lot more nervous. And in my experience, they are more likely to sort of break down and give off tells. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what a tournament is. Like, everybody enters a tournament and they pay a buy-in that they're comfortable with, and say it's a 1K, they're playing for 1K in equity at that point. But if they get to the final table, they're playing essentially a new tournament where their stack is maybe worth 100K and there's $500,000 up top. And there's a lot of pressure on them, and they start to act in different ways, and they can give information off. That actually reminds me of the single biggest equity I ever gained from picking up a tell. Was that in 2015, I made a final table at the World Series of Poker. And I went in, I think I was the second shortest stack at the start. And I had been short stack most of the way, so my decisions were reasonably standard. I had a spot where I think I might have been up to third shortest now at this point. I think Jason Kuhn had just been greatly cut down by the eventual winner, Pesh, and there was another guy short. And there were seven or eight left at this point. I was in the cutoff, and I looked down at ace-queen. Jason's just ahead of me, and Jason had 12 big blinds, if I remember correctly, and he opened for a min-raise. So I was now deciding, do I 3-bet or do I shove? And while I was doing that, I was looking down the table, and I saw the big blind look at his cards and then literally sit upright like he'd been struck by electricity. He was visibly very, very excited. So I thought to myself, okay, well, he definitely has a hand. And what does that mean now? So after some thought, I decided to fold, figuring that if he has a hand and, you know, I get it in against him and lose when I'm 6 of 8 or whatever I was, that's an ICM disaster for me. So I folded, he shoved. And to my surprise, Jason, who had opened off 12 big blinds, folded. Mm. And I remember thinking, wow, that's really weird. I'm interested to see what Jason's hand is. It has to be like a really weak ace or something, which is just going to be always dominated. And I was really surprised to see his hand when I watched it back. He had pocket eights, which is not a hand you would ever raise fold. You would either shove it yourself because it loses far too much equity to raise fold, or you wouldn't open it if you decided to be really, really nitty because it doesn't have any blockers. So my only conclusion was that what I saw, he saw as well. He saw the big blind have the same reaction, and he decided, even though I'm supposed to continue with my eights here, my eights are never good. That was an example of a very high equity situation where the very fact that I saw that paid off for every hour I'd ever spent thinking about tells.
Oh yeah, yeah. And your point about, you know, tournaments can be very high stakes situations, which means there are these more of these tells that come up when people are very polarized and they're emotion. I mean, that reminds me, I've never played many tournaments. I've only played literally like a handful because I've mainly played cash games. And for anybody who's listening who doesn't know the difference, you know, tournaments are when you buy in and there's a set ending, and cash games are just like the kind of games you sit in and they don't end. You can buy it, you can cash out at any time. But yeah, it reminds me when I did play one tournament, like a couple $100 tournament, and noticed a similar thing of somebody behind me who'd been acting very loose, you know, behaviorally loose, physically loose, sitting right behind me for most hands. And then all of a sudden I see him get very still behind me, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay. And I was going to raise in late position, but decided not to. Similar kind of thing. But yeah, those kinds of tells can be very valuable. And I should say too, you know, when we're talking about the value of tells, there's just so much to say here. And I think, you know, one important thing is that even though against good players, against skilled players, those spots of being, you know, knowing that something is very reliable don't come up that often. It's also true that against very strong, you know, equally matched competition, you can be looking for those spots that just like make your decision go one way or another. And For example, I interviewed Brian Rast, who's a high stakes cash game player and tournament player. And he talked about those, you know, very borderline spots that often come up where you're kind of on the fence of in a lot of decisions versus very skilled players. And he was talking specifically about triple draw. I think it was deuce to seven triple draw, which is where you, it's a very closely matched game because you have, and you don't have hardly any information about the other person except what cards they drew and how they bet. So, and he was describing how in those like very borderline on the fence spots, you know, tells really come into play even against quite good players because they're just looking for tiny little things that, you know, maybe it's like 55% reliable, 60% reliable, 70% reliable. It's not very reliable, but over time, those little decisions, if you're making them more consistently and you're making a lot of them, can really add up. And I think that's worth saying because, you know, while we're talking about, you know, you can overestimate them, you can underestimate them, but there's definitely, even for fairly low reliable ones, there can be a lot of value there over time.
Yeah, that's a very good point. The story I just told, that's one of the few times in my career where I've been almost certain that a player's behavior meant he had a very strong strong hand. Most of the time, it's exactly like you say. You would put a percentage on it: 55%, 60%, 65%, whatever the percentage is. And a lot of the time, it doesn't come down to anything specific other than how comfortable they look. Relaxation is very, very hard to fake, but you can still get a very good sense from looking at somebody how relaxed they are, and also how focused they are. I mean, one of the areas where you get the biggest amount of information early on in hands is when somebody who is, you know, very relaxed and gabby looks at their cards and suddenly becomes very still and very quiet. You know, that's never a hand that they're going to fold.
Yeah, and Antonio Esfandiari is one who talks a lot about the vibe or the aura or something, you know, which I think is, you know, he talks about these indefinable things of getting a sense of people's strength or weakness, their feeling. And I think there's something to that in the sense that, you know, I think he's pointing at the fact that even if you, a lot of times for these close decisions, some of it can rely on a gut feeling or maybe even things that you're not aware of that have to do with how much the person's moving, you know, like kind of like micro movements, like are they just slightly more tense and still than usual in a certain situation? I think he's getting at those things that are kind of hard to notice, you know, like when you're watching a video of the footage or something. Subtle, really subtle things. Yeah,
I think that's very true. Like, I think I'm reasonably good at reading people, but I don't think I'm one of the best. And I know a few people who I suspect are one of the best. One of them is Andy Black, the Irish player who has won more live than either Irish player. And I think a huge amount of his edge just comes from reading people. And I hung up out with Andy in Vegas and we were doing a sort of an information exchange where he was telling me the stuff that he was good at and I was giving him rundown on game theory and how younger players were playing. But one thing that I remember about our conversation is when we were talking about three betting, and I was obviously coming out from a technical perspective, talking about the way three betting ranges are constructed. And Andy said to me, like, always look at the guy before and just after his three bet, and you'll get a set. The phrase he used was aces feels very different from kings and kings feels different from queens. So he obviously felt that he had his antenna are so finely tuned to this stuff that he can almost put somebody on a specific hand. And I mean, I guess it does kind of make sense. I've never had that sort of sixth sense, but it does make sense that if somebody has aces, they're obviously going to be super relaxed. They know that no matter what happens, they have the best hand. If they have kings and it's a high pressure situation, they're slightly worried that, you know, we all remember the times we had kings and we ran into aces. Mm-hmm. And then queens is more vulnerable still.
Yeah, and I should say, I definitely don't feel I am the best or anywhere near the best at reading tells. I think some people assume that because I've, you know, written books about it, that they think I am. But really, my interest in it is about trying to communicate what is going on here. It doesn't mean that in the moment I'm the best at reading tells. In fact, like, I sometimes my mind is just kind of blank and I'm nervous and can't focus on everything around me. And there's just too much information. And I think there's plenty of people that, you know, like Phil Ivey's probably much, much better than I am at reading tells in the moment, that things like that. But I think, my work was about like, what is actually going on here? Like, what are the factors we can actually figure out and talk about that are going on, regardless of like, if Brian Rast is making a kind of a, or anybody's making a kind of quick read that they're not consciously aware of. They might not even know what the factors are, but can we put those factors into words, which I think is the tough part sometimes to have it make sense, because it's really hard to talk about behaviors, especially when so many different situations mean different things and there's so many factors in any specific poker spot. But thinking about Andy Black and people like Phil Hellmuth, and I wonder if there's something too about how some people know how people respond to them. Like when I think about Andy Black or Hellmuth, I think about they seem to be more on the talkative, interactive side, which I think, you know, and they come to learn how people react to them. And I think a big part of Hellmuth's edge, for example, is he has celebrity, which makes people behave a certain way because some people just want to play more pots with you and don't mind losing to you. And then he also gets under people's skin a little bit and kind of can kind of, you know, jibe them and insult them. And he kind of knows how people might react to that in different ways. Like, for example, if someone's bluffing him and he starts insulting them and they just remain completely neutral and conciliatory, then that's a sign that they're bluffing and not relaxed. Yeah. And then if they're joking or insulting him back, that's a sign that they're relaxed and value betting.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's something that Andy clearly does. It's part of his game to talk. And actually, he encouraged me to introduce that to my game too. Now, it doesn't come naturally to me at all. I'm one of those people who prefers to just sort of sit there and concentrate mm-hmm. on the strategy.
And me too, yeah, because I'm honestly just not that social and I get a little anxious at the poker table. So that kind of stuff does not come naturally to me, but I definitely see how it can be valuable for many people. Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, that's one of the major pieces of advice I give to inexperienced players, inexperienced player life, be they just players who are generally inexperienced or players who've only played online when they go out to play, say, the World Series. Tell them, like, don't get sucked into talking to these people. That's where a lot mm-hmm. of their edge comes from. They're not mm-hmm. talking to be friendly. They're talking to try and get information from you. If you're at a table with Negreanu and he's being all gabby, that's because that's very much part of his MO. He will be able to pick up when you are relaxed in the middle of a hand compared to when you're not relaxed, and you don't want to give off that information at all. So the best thing to do is to just shut it down completely. And I mean, that's difficult to do because we have the sort of social imperative when somebody talks to us to answer back,
right?
But you do have to sort of cut that off at the poker table.
Yeah, that is a big factor. I think people, even quite skilled players, don't really realize how much skilled live telefocused players can get when you interact with someone. And it's not just about that moment, it's about the discrepancy over time, right? Like how you're reacting in one spot, it may not mean much in that specific moment, especially if you're, you know, you have a big hand or something, but the discrepancy and the difference over time it can mean a lot, can show a lot to people who are good at picking up on that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing people like Andy are very good at is just changing the whole metagame to suit them. So you will see players like that react very differently to players at the same table. You know, they'll be very, very friendly to other players and they'll be more hostile to other players. And that's because they feel that if they're hostile to somebody, for example, that person might break down and give away information or might play in a suboptimal way. Whereas if they're, and the same can happen if they're friendly to someone. And he told me that he actually learned this lesson on his first trip to Vegas, and he had Stu Unger to his immediate right, the legendary Stu Unger. And Stu was incredibly nice and chatty to him and complimenting him. And afterwards, Andy realized that he had played much more passively against Stu as a result. He had stopped three betting him as much because he felt like they were friends. And, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. and this is something I've seen Andy do in tournaments as well. If Andy has a very skilled player to his immediate left, he will be extremely charming mm-hmm. with them. And he obviously feels that's an area where he can get an edge as well.
No, for sure. Yeah. And even in that gaining rapport, yeah, there's definitely some, it adds to basically your radar of that person, you know, aside from them, you know, maybe not playing you as hard, it can add to the things you pick up, sort of like in the same way that when you're, if Hellmuth is insulting someone, there's some extra radar things that he can pick up there.
Yeah, I think when it comes to picking up information, like there's a sort of when people are very, very relaxed, that they can give away information because they're too relaxed. And they're not really thinking about that. And when people are very, very tense, when you go to the other end of the scale, I think the zone in the middle is where you kind of want to be. You don't want to be either too relaxed or too nervous. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you can move somebody in either direction out of that sort of central zone to where they're either too nervous because maybe you're being hostile to them and now they're thinking about that, or too relaxed because you're being very, very friendly and now they think it's just a friendly game. That can be very much to your advantage when it comes to reading them.
Yeah, I think that helps explain, you know, kind of in an almost like evolutionary sense, how there's some players that have just come to be very annoying. Like that's part of their strategy, you know, in the sense that there's different routes you can take in the poker world. you know, focusing on strategy, focusing on, you know, being annoying and reading how people respond to that. And I think it helps explain, like, there's different routes you can go. And actually, I want to talk about when you were talking about the early hand tells, you know, the three bet spots and those kind of spots pre-flop. You know, when I was playing, I don't play much anymore. I haven't played for a while, actually. But when I was playing regularly, back when I was working on Exploiting Poker Tells, which was my last book around 2016, 2017, I came to realize the most frequently used kinds of tells I was relying on were the early hand tells when somebody was raising preflop, three betting preflop. I was using the indicators of lack of focus, which would be like somebody, you know, a raiser was moving around a little bit more, not as seemingly mentally focused. They would joke around a little bit more. They would say something. So I would use those indicators as spots to re-raise pre-flop or on the flop if they were doing similar things as spots to raise them or maybe call and continue and see what happens on the next street. And I realized that it goes against the common knowledge, I think, because I think a lot of people think that it's all about those big bet spots. You know, we're looking for like signs of bluffing or weakness when somebody makes a big bet on the river or whatever, which can be true. I think in lower stakes games, it happens more frequently, but you know, when you're playing somewhat decent players, those kinds of things don't happen as often for the reasons we said, like people are better. They're more cognizant. They're trying to be, you know, those are the spots they're trying to be most balanced in. But those early hand tells I think are huge. And it's something I haven't really written about much. Like I'd say if there's one thing that I haven't really focused as much on, it's the importance of those early hand tells. And I was actually talking to Alex Fitzgerald, who goes by the name of Assassinato. He's got a poker coaching business too. And, you know, we were talking about that and how much he sees there. And I was like, yeah, it's like, I haven't really emphasized that. And yeah, I'm curious, you know, sort of like you were saying, you were saying you see some of those early hand spots too.
Yeah, I think I see those much more than anything else, to be honest. One of the problems with, you know, by the time we get to the river, if it's a big pot, then, you know, everybody's focused. Nobody's relaxed at that point. I think one of the difficulties with the whole area of tells is, and this is a point you make very well in the book, that you have to sort of correlate it to the person rather than just go off a general principle, is that nervousness and excitement look very, very similar to the outside person. And actually, they are very, very similar. I mean, the way they physiologically express themselves is pretty much the same, to the point that when I was a competitive runner, my coach used to say, if you feel nervous before a race, trick yourself into thinking it's not nervousness, it's excitement, and this excitement will give me more energy. Because nervousness and excitement do feel the same as well. So you see somebody shaking, that could be oh, they're bluffing and they're very, very nervous, or it could be they're sitting there with the absolute best possible hand and they're very excited, right? Because they're about to win a big pot. So you kind of have to rewind back to the start of the hand when they were more relaxed. Another point I would say on that is sometimes you do see a moment where their behavior just completely changes. And that basically means typically it means they've gone from, you know, being fairly relaxed because their hand wasn't very good to suddenly their hand is very good. Or else, you know, occasionally they're thinking about a big bluff, but that's usually...
The perfect example of that is somebody like casually just chatting about something, and then the next card comes and their sentence just kind of wanders out, wanders off, and they go quiet. You know, that's like the stereotypical. Like,
yeah, now they've hit their set.
Yeah. They're like, what was I saying?
Yeah. And I think the last ever live stream I played on was Unibet Open Dublin just before the pandemic. And there was an example of that. I'm sure I'm going to butcher the hand now, but my memory of the hand is I opened ace king and the guy beside me looked very relaxed and he just called. So immediately I'm thinking, okay, well, he doesn't have a super strong hand. He just has a hand which he figures he has to call, you know, something decent like Jack 10 suited or a pocket pair typically. And then I think the big blind called as well. And the flop came ace king 4. And I was looking at him and I saw that sort of moment where he went from not being too concerned with the hand to suddenly being very, very interested in the hand. And I thought, oh, well, this is interesting. So big blind checks, I bet. He calls. He's trying to look very casual, but I can see that he's kind of faking it. So now I'm kind of thinking, okay, well, I mean, he could just have an ace as well.
and maybe he's overvaluing an ace. Or he could have ace four suited, for example, and that's a very strong hand, not quite as strong as my hand. So the big blind folds, and then turn is an inconsequential card. And I checked, and he did a couple of things which convinced me he was absolutely at the top of his range. So for the first thing he did was he looked kind of like, he tried to fake like, oh, what should I do here? And then he glanced at my stack. And that's a tell I found to be reasonably reliable. When somebody glances at your stack and then bets, it's almost like they're sizing up, okay, how much should I bet here that he's going to call? That's kind of the mental process that's going on there. And he did some verbalization to suggest that he wasn't very happy with his hand, but he was going to bet anyway, which, again, having read your excellent book, Reading Verbal Tells, I kind of knew that's definitely a monster too. So I folded pretty quickly and I just said to him, which set did you have? And he seemed quite annoyed. And then the commentators told me later he had pocket fours, so he had flopped a bottom set. But that was that was a case where, you know, like, I'm never ever supposed to fold that hand if I'm playing strictly by the theory. But it was a combination of everything, sort of breaking his range down to include a lot, mostly pocket pairs, because of his early sort of relaxation. Well, I'm only going to be interested in this hand if I hit a set. To wow, now I've hit my set, so I'm very, very interested. And then all the kind of misdirections he tried.
Yeah, well, I think you've hit something really important there, which I think a lot of spots there are multiple indicators of something going the same way, you know. And I think even when some players, you know, are understandably skeptical of using tells, there are just so many spots where there are like two or more indicators pointing the same way, like in the spot you just said. And I think, you know, if you watch some really high stakes tournaments, you will see multiple spots where, even if you didn't want to rely on one tell, there's like, if you know about tells, there are like multiple things pointing one way. And, you know, like, for example, that thing you mentioned of glancing towards someone's stack. I mean, that in one way, that's an interpretation of, you know, they're thinking about how much can I get. And one reason I think you don't see that from bluffers, you're less likely to see that from bluffers, is because glancing at someone's chip stack can be perceived as like an aggressive, insulting thing to do almost. It's kind of an aggressive thing, which is why most bluffers will not, you know, they'll want to avoid those more aggressive things because they don't want to accidentally, you know, trigger someone into being insulted or equally aggressive. So there's these ways that things add up in various ways. And I think that's what I say to people who are skeptical of these things, is like, you can just find so many, easily find so many examples of multiple tells pointing the same way, and it happens so often. Again, though, it should say that that's not a, if you're playing against decent players, that becomes less likely, but it's still, I can definitely show people high stakes WSOP main event tournaments, like final table tournaments, where you still see those kinds of things. Like, you know, you were talking about the weak hand statement, as I call them, when somebody, you know, weakens their range a little bit directly or indirectly, like you can still find some of those very prominent things, which are probably like the most reliable kind of things. And I have plenty of examples of that from the final table. And then, you know, good players would end up, you know, calling those kind of bets sometimes. And I'm just like, well, if you knew even just a little bit about poker tells, you would know, like, that would be a pretty, you know, you'd be much better off folding in that spot. And so I think it points to the fact that, yeah, we've talked about how you can definitely overestimate tells' importance, but I think a lot of people just straight up underestimate them, especially if they come from a more online background. They know, you know, they can obviously win big time without those things, which is obviously true too.
Yeah, absolutely. And one other point I'd say is that as you play against more and more sophisticated players, if you are placing too much emphasis on tells, you can open yourself to exploitation as well. It's always the case that when you diverge sort of from optimal theoretical play because of other information, that if the other person figures that out, they can counter exploit you. I've done that a few times in my career. Early on in my career, I ran into an older Irish live player who used to enjoy telling us all how great he was at reading us all at the table. And it was obvious to me he'd read, you know, Kara's book of tells. So I read it too. Less interested in trying to pick stuff up, but more interested in how he will interpret certain behaviors. Mm-hmm. And for the next couple of years, I could literally get him to think whatever I wanted at the table. You know, I would stare at the flop when I'd hit it. And he would think, okay, well, Kara says when somebody stares at a flop, they've missed. I would glare at him when I was value betting, which he always interpreted as a bluff. And so on. And there is always that danger. And you know, on the other side, I've run into some very, very sophisticated players through my career who play a very exploitative style, where they're clearly compensating for what they're giving up theoretically by their ability to read people. And there's a couple of players who spring to mind on that. The top Belgian player, Davide Kataj, the two things people say about him is he's technically atrocious, or at least he's technically very unorthodox. And the second thing is he reads people amazingly. Now, I got Davide to get it in drawing dead in an EPT, where he gave me a 10-minute stare down. So it goes back to, like, I don't believe that they can actually read you. They have sort of a book of in their head, which they think, okay, well, if he does this, it means this. Mm-hmm. But if somebody knows that and they know what your playbook is, and then they can sort of hijack that.
Yeah, you point out I talk in the books about, I don't recommend using false tells, but as you say, there are definitely spots, and one of the situations that's great for that is if you are pretty sure that your opponent, you know, is using some of the commonly known tells to make their decisions. And also, I think the other part of that equation is hopefully they don't have a high opinion of you and think that you're capable. Yeah. You know, they're kind of reading you as like they would just an average person on the street, or they don't know much about you, in other words. So yeah, I think there's definitely spots, like you've said, like I've done that too, where I thought somebody was kind of like at this certain level of skill, and they didn't know who I was at all, so they were going to interpret my stuff in the usual standard ways, right? Yeah, so I think there's definitely those kinds of situations. Yeah,
I think the point you make about them not having a high opinion of your game is crucial. Like I said, I was able to do a lot of this in the early days, playing in Ireland, when I was less known than I am now. There's a difference for me between, say, I'm playing in Ireland and I just kind of assume everybody at the table knows me, although that's not necessarily always the case. And if I go and play somewhere like Australia, where the vast majority of people won't know me, you know, they'll look at a guy in his mid-50s who looks like a tourist, and they'll have a very different opinion. And that's actually a very useful image to have, because they're much more relaxed around you and they're much more likely to sort of just pigeonhole you based on population tendencies.
Yeah, when I played in Vegas, I haven't played that much in Vegas, but when I used to go there for a few WSOPs and play cash games, I used to wear a business shirt, like a polo shirt with a business logo on it. So I looked like I was in town for like a business conference.
Yeah.
maybe that's kind of weird. I don't know.
Yeah.
I was curious, I know many people listen to your Chip Race podcast, and you're well known from other things too, but do you feel like everybody who listens to your Chip Race podcast, do you feel like you're pretty recognized? I guess what I'm trying to say, does everybody who listens to the podcast know who you are in person?
Almost everybody, I would say. I think I have a reasonably distinctive voice. So often as soon as I talk, people make the connection. But then, you know, I'm sponsored by Univet now. I do wear a patch with Chip Race as well. So the very fact of wearing patches means that even if people don't know who you are, they are sort of tipped off to the fact that, well, you're clearly not just a tourist in town.
So maybe a good place to go next is, you know, one of the things I love about poker and why I find it so interesting is that it's such a complex game. It's an endeavor you could spend your whole life on and continually be improving at, you know, whether that's the strategic part of the game, which is just so massively complex, or the psychology and tells side of the game. But I think all that means, all that complexity means that there's kind of a Dunning-Kruger effect, where the longer you play, the more you're aware of what you don't know about the game, and realizing that the game is so much more complex than you thought at first. That awareness can kind of make you question your game more and more over time. And I don't know if you can relate to this, but I've had that feeling as I've gotten older, almost feel like with all the growing complexity that I'm aware of in these spots that I used to not think about that much, like I feel like I've become worse in some regard, and just the sense of my skill has gone up, you know, objectively, but I question myself more, and I'm curious if you can relate to that at all.
I can totally relate to that. I mean, that is completely my experience. With every passing year, I feel less and less confident in every spot that I'm in. And I find it amazing that even now when I'm playing online, you know, there'll be some incredibly standard spot where I've opened off 40 big blinds and the big blind is defending, the flops come down. And I'm looking at the board going like, why do I not know what to do here? This is ridiculous.
I know, yeah. I can totally relate to that. I mean, I feel like it's like a Hamlet thing. It's like I've become like Hamlet of poker, where I'm like, the spots that used to seem completely standard to me, and now I'm just like, well, what exactly is going on here, really? And like, if I think about the game theory aspect, and this is so much more complex than I thought. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And the other side of that is, like, I do a lot of coaching now, and students send me hands, and my response always is okay, well, I'll run it, and I'll get back to you. In other words, I'll put it into a solver, and then I'll talk you through the output. But sometimes they get annoyed with that and say, well, what's your opinion? And my opinion is, my opinion is worthless. It's like, why do you want to hear my opinion? It's just, you know, it might be wrong. It could very well be wrong. And even if it's right, it's probably just right by chance. It's really not anything you should be placing any stock on. What I'm good at is, I'm good at, like, programming the solver and then explaining the output to you, explaining this is why we check raise this hand, or this is why this hand is a check call, etc., etc. But you know, don't ask me in advance, because the game is just so incredibly complex. Most players my generation hate the arrival of the solvers, because they feel that people can improve very quickly now to using the solvers, but I love it, because it has sort of added this complexity to the game, where you can actually break down a spot in enormous detail, and you're looking for sort of the explanation of why the output is the way it is. And I love that sort of puzzle aspect. Well, why do we never check raise on this board, but we always check raise on that board? And why are we using this particular hand to check raise? That sort of stuff is fascinating to me. But when it comes to play, yeah, I mean, I'm still looking at boards going like, yeah, I mean, I think I'm supposed to bet here, but I'm not even sure what size I'm supposed to use. How do I not know this stuff? I've spent literally thousands of hours looking at solver output in similar spots, and I'm still completely lost here.
Well, and to your point too, it's, you know, talking about many players, you know, getting better with these more established, you know, game theory optimal solutions. I mean, I think one reason that maybe shouldn't bug people as much is that there still is so much room for exploitation. And if you're focused on the optimal, you know, the game theory optimal solutions, that those things don't necessarily help you go into a game of like pretty weak players and optimize your winnings, which I think there's still so much room there for, you know. And I think it should encourage people who are interested in poker, because, you know, if you're playing game theory optimal in a game with a bunch of loose, very bad players, you are not going to be making your ideal win rate, because there are so many ways to exploit the specific ways that people play, let alone the tells aspect of like looking for those spots. There's just so many sources of exploitation.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, like, the solvers now can also help you to exploit. But very, very people use that. Very few people use that functionality. Mm. They just focus on the game theory optimal. But like, as an example, a couple of years ago, I played a spot against an older French player, and I had some very, very specific reads on the way that he played. He didn't fold before the river unless if he had anything. If he was checked to, he generally bet, and if you bet yourself, he generally called. There was almost no raising, so I had a spot where I had the sort of the perfect check raise bluff hand, and I got there on the river, which is one of the reasons it was perfect check raise hand, because it could get there on the river. So I was fairly sure that check raising him was correct. It shut down the action, and I took control of the hand. But I ran the spot afterwards, and from a game theory perspective, yes, my hand was one of my few check raises. But then when I node locked, as the technical term is node locking is where you tell the solver, okay, my opponent is not playing optimally. He's playing this strategy, no raising, no folding of any hand that has any sort of equity. And so what do we do against somebody who's playing like that? And the results were staggering to me. The solver now literally just check raised everything. Absolutely everything. And if he checked behind on the turn, it generally checked the turn. And if he checked behind, it always bluffed the river, because his strategy is basically telling us on the turn whether he has a hand or not. And if he doesn't have a hand, this solver goes ahead and overbets the river, which is exactly what a very good human would do as well. But you know, that's not something I would have been able to work out in game, that this is a very obvious exploit to somebody who's playing the way that he is. I was more focused on the fact that if I get there, he'll pay me off, and having taken control of the hand, he won't raise me, so I won't get blown off my equity.
Yeah, as you can probably tell, I've never used a solver, but that's interesting that you can plug in what you think of the other player's strategy and use that in the solver. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, another spot I've been looking at a lot recently is a lot of live players in particular, they just don't check raise very often. You know, they defend their big blind, and if they have something, they check call. I was interested to see how the solver would exploit that strategy. And what the solver does is it bets a lot more in position because there are certain hands you don't want to bet, because if you get check raised, you have to fold them. But if the guy never check raises, then you don't have to worry about that. So you can pretty much just bet everything. But the second exploit, which is interesting, is the sizing completely changes. The solver, you know, on a certain board, it might bet one third pot typically, but now it goes all the way up to pot because it's going, well, you know, he's not going to fold. When I have a strong hand, I want to get as much money into the pot as possible. Mm-hmm. When you have a very strong hand yourself, a lot of the value of that hand comes from when you bet it and get check raised. But if he's never going to check raise you, you have to put the money in yourself.
Mm. Yeah. So you're either getting value or you're making a good size of bluff. So fold.
Yeah. And you also, yeah, obviously the bigger size you use, the more you get to bluff from a theoretical point of view as well.
Yeah. I think a lot of people who don't play poker that much or don't play poker at all, you know, I think it's worth saying that poker is just so complex. I think a lot of people have the sense that it's like, oh, it's about knowing what percentage of the hands your flush will beat or whatever. You know, I don't think many people understand just how complex in a game theory sense is. And for anyone who wants to dig into that, you should look up how complex poker is in comparison to chess and see how complex the, as they call it, the game tree is, and how hard it is for AI programs to solve poker. I'll just leave it there. But I do think a lot of people just don't realize. They have kind of a sense that poker is similar to blackjack or something. So I just want to give props to poker for being very complex for the lay audience before we...
I think part of that is poker sort of has ignoble gambling game origins, so people do kind of think it is gambling. And when I got into poker and I was coming out of running at the time, the biggest problem I had explaining to my running friends was that it was even possible to win at poker. Mm-hmm. They literally saw it as a pure game of chance. Mm-hmm. which again is a fairly popular misconception. My wife understands games pretty well, and I played chess at a reasonably high level too, but you know, I completely back up what you say. Poker is a much more complex game, and she gets that too. Like it annoys her that sort of chess is seen as this wonderful noble mind sport where they're all geniuses just because they're good at chess, and poker is sort of this grubby backroom game where people are hustling each other and there's not much skill to it. Whereas from a game theory perspective, it's completely the opposite.
A note here, it might be worth pointing out that even though poker contains so much complexity, one reason it's less respected is just how slowly the decisions are made, at least in traditional live games, and how much chance does play a role in the short term. In other words, No Limit Hold'em may technically be more complex to solve from a game theory perspective than chess and other complex games, but the number of intellectual decisions you're making over time in a live game is just so slow compared to chess. That becomes much less true online when you're having to make a lot more decisions. It becomes tougher, and the long-term effects of your good or bad decisions are reached more quickly. So I just wanted to throw that in, as it helps explain some of the perception of poker. Back to the interview.
Just to double back on my earlier point about, you know, the solver in this spot where we're not getting check raised, making big bets, that's something that live players have always done. You know, when they're playing against that type of player who doesn't check raise, they'll put in big bets. And then sometimes you see guys coming from the game theory perspective, and they go out, they've played for years online, and they go out playing live, and they come back and they say, oh, they're all terrible. They're making these huge big bets on boards where it makes absolutely no sense. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the reality is they're doing, you know, they are playing optimal for the players they're playing against. And that's always something, you know, one of the ways you see that poker is a very complex game is that you can have very, very different styles and they're all winning. People are doing complete opposite. So you can never say absolutely like, don't do this, don't do that.
Right.
If there's a player who's doing it and he's winning, you need to sort of break it down and say, well, why is he winning? I mean, yes, it's bad from a game theory perspective, but still he's winning. And the way I normally put it is to put it in terms of the rock, paper, scissors game. Obviously, the theoretical solution to that is to randomize and take one in three for each one randomly so that you can't be exploited. But if somebody is throwing paper most of the time, then you don't want to do that anymore. You want to take scissors. But it's still complex, because if you like take scissors 100% of the time, he's going to change his behavior pretty quickly. And it's similar in poker. There is a game theoretical optimal way to play it, but nobody is playing it perfectly. And some people are playing a long way from perfect. And you're much better off figuring out how to exploit.
And there's multiple, you know, theoretically multiple, well, almost certainly multiple game theory solutions for any spot in poker. Like, wouldn't you say that's true? I mean, we may not know them all, but theoretically there's like multiple solutions for many spots where you could take one of several actions as long as you had a consistent total strategy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's that also, you know, is making your point of like when people are doing something when we don't understand it in poker, probably in any situation, there can be reasons there that we don't understand. So it can be hard to jump to conclusions and be like, that's clearly wrong, because even for a player you think is completely horrible, like maybe it'll come out that that's actually, you know, a very, you know, legitimate solution that they've taken for that specific spot. You know, there's a reason why maybe they're doing that, or maybe even doing it accidentally, but it's not as horrible as you think it is, you know? So I think that's, it's almost like a philosophical thing really of like reserve judgment, because you never really know what the factors are.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. The thing is with solvers now, we can sort of break down and see why certain things are working, but you know, the solvers have educated on a lot of things too. Like if you go back 10 years ago and you asked people what you should do from the small blind if it's folded around to you, the vast majority of good players would have said either raise or fold, never limp. Now, the solvers have proven to us that the correct strategy at shallower stack depths, at least, involves a lot of limping. Mm-hmm. There are other spots where you know, the game theory solution is quite different from what human intuition thinks it is. A lot of human intuition around poker is based around sort of wish fulfillment more than anything else. When you're in the small blind, for example, you don't like to have to play the entire hand out of position. So that kind of pushes you to either fold and the hand is over, or raise and hope the guy folds and you won't have to play the hand out of position.
It's our discomfort, yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of what drives that strategy. Similarly, like there's a lot of spots where humans will say, oh, just move all in after the flop because you have enough equity. And that's just because they're in a difficult spot and they know that they can't fold. So they just move all in. But, you know, again, if you break down the spot, often that's not the optimal strategy, because, you know, if you have a very, very strong hand, you don't want to just move all in and get the guy to fold. So therefore, when you have a strong hand, you should be betting smaller amounts, and but you can't switch to a strategy unless you're playing against somebody who's completely unsophisticated, of just betting a small amount with your strong hands and moving all in with your less strong hands. But the human approach to poker is more of a desire to avoid unclear spots rather than what's the actual best play here.
And if all this sounds too intimidating for people that are thinking about playing poker, I should also say a lot of that stuff you won't have to deal with for a while. Like if you get into poker and you play live, for example, at low stakes, there's simply a lot of just simply bad players. So I don't want to make poker sound like you have to be thinking about all of these super complex things. They're, you know, a large bulk of taking money out of the game in poker is it coming from pretty weak players, and there are a lot of weak players. So I just wanted to give that a promotional poker.
Yeah, promotion. No, it is a good point. Yeah.
It's possible to make it sound too scary and intimidating, but you know, then that's one thing I love about poker. It is so complex. It's a lifetime endeavor of learning theoretically if you're interested in it. And but you can get started right away. So I was curious if you see any crossover from marathon running to poker. I'd imagine that that kind of training would help in long tournaments, helping you keep your cool and keep your focus.
Yeah, there's obviously some physical benefits to being fit. Like I always feel that my biggest edge in live tournaments comes towards the end of the day when people are getting tired, and I'm getting tired too, but to a way lesser degree. But I would say probably the biggest one is just the ability to just keep doing the same thing over and over again. Training for a marathon and even running a marathon to a large degree is pretty dull. Like you're never going flat out on your feet for a long time. You're doing the same thing over and over again, and you kind of have to be able to just accept that and not mix things up just for the sake of mixing it up. Mm-hmm. It's the same in poker. Like one area I see this really come out is when very, very good online players go out and play live for the first time, and it's such a different game live, because when they're playing online, you know, maybe they're playing 20 tables, and each table is playing 60 hands an hour. So they're playing 1,200 hands an hour. So they never get bored. Then they go out and play live, where you play 25 hands an hour if you're lucky. And now they're just bored out of their minds. They're like, because you're mostly folding. So, you know, you're playing 25 hands. If you're lucky, you're only folding 20 of those before the flop. You know, they'll come and they'll say, okay, well, I had this hand and I raised. And I'll go like, why did you raise that hand? Would you ever do that online? And they go, no, I didn't. No, I wouldn't. But they'll say, oh, well, I hadn't played a hand in a while. And I thought they thought I was tired. They'll come up with all sorts of justifications.
Mm-hmm. These players were weak. I had to get in there.
These players were weak. Yeah, that's the other great one. Yeah. Oh, I can definitely get away with opening A7.
You should see how they were playing. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas the reality is, like, the way you exploit really weak players, for the most part, is just by waiting for very clear spots, waiting for very strong hands and value betting. But yeah, people get bored and they do all sorts of weird stuff just because they want to get fancy and get away from that boredom. So I don't think it's just marathon running. I have noticed there are other sports too where people come across and they tend to be very good. One of the interesting ones is snooker. I don't think I've ever met a snooker player who was terrible at poker.
Interesting.
And you would think, well, there's no correlation there, but there is, because there's a, you know, snooker players at the top level, they have to practice for hours and hours, and they're just literally doing the same thing over and over again, without diverging, and the whole purpose is literally to just try and do the same thing over and over again. So I think any endeavor which gives you that sort of preparation for doing the same thing over and over again without getting bored, and that boredom causing you to do stuff that you would normally do, is good preparation.
Speaking of sports and poker, I was invited on this sort of like promotional documentary. It was called David versus Goliath, and it was a thing with David Hay, the boxer. And
my friend Katie was involved in this.
So basically, I went to Vegas and had a meeting with him because he was a boxer who'd was trying to get into poker, and it was just a promotional thing. Like, he had never really played poker, but the casino, I can't remember. It was the casino, the big casino in
Grosvenor.
Yeah. Grosvenor. Yeah. Anyway, I just have to say, it's a great unintentional comedy. If anybody in the poker world wants to watch it, it's basically about how they expected him to actually like take it seriously and try to learn poker, but he has zero interest in it. So he doesn't improve whatsoever and just like immediately loses all his chips whenever he plays. And then at the end, they buy him into the big tournament, like literally like 16 times, and then act impressed when he like, you know, advanced pretty far. And I mean, I gotta say, if you're in the poker world, you will find it very unintentionally hilarious, because the guy just does not care about playing poker whatsoever. So
I'm friends with a few of the Grosvenor pros, and I did get a sense of that from them. Not quite as brutally honest as the one you just gave.
Well, yeah, I think people are afraid to throw it on their bus, but because they're like involved in it. But I was like, I was involved in it. It was pretty funny. I don't mind knocking it. I mean, it's like obvious like how he feels about the game. So it's like, it's just the truth. Anyway, it's fun.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say about tells that we haven't touched on? Any other crazy anecdotes spring to mind?
One anecdote from early in my career. This is before I was known, so this is why most of these things were possible at the time. But just to get out of the house when I was purely an online player, I used to go and play in my local pub. They had a game every Thursday or whatever it was. And, you know, there was only 20, 25 people, whatever. And it was very relaxed. And it was one of these nonsense structures where everybody starts with a ridiculous amount of chips. But, you know, 10-minute blinds. And before long, everybody has 6 big blinds. And that's the way the game plays out. But there was one lady there who, she did pretty well in the game, I have to say. She obviously had no idea who I was, because I was just an online player at the time. So she was just looking at this sort of middle-aged guy who didn't seem to know what he was doing, and that was very much her impression of me. So she used to constantly like give me lectures on, oh, you're far too tight, you need to bluff more, you need to do this and do that. But she had the most pronounced tell I've ever seen. It was incredible. It was a hand tell. Every time she bet, she would move chips into the pot. And if she was value betting, that was it. She would just place the chips and there was nothing more. But if she was bluffing, after she'd placed the chips, she would literally wave her hands over the chips. I classify that mentally as she's waving those chips goodbye. she knows if she's called, they're gone. So I would literally just stare at her hands for the whole game, and I would know with 100% accuracy whether she was bluffing or not. And it was interesting how she internalized that, because she did realize after a certain point that, you know, he always seems to know whether I'm bluffing or not. But she couldn't get over over her initial read that I was this inexperienced player who hadn't a clue what I was doing. So she said, "You're incredibly lucky. You seem to always guess right whether I'm bluffing or not." You know, that kind of goes back to, it's a lot easier to pick that stuff up if they have a very low opinion of you. And I certainly found, as I became known as one of the more successful players in Ireland, it was a lot more difficult to exploit that stuff.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, there are definitely positives and negatives to being perceived as either a strong player or a weak casual player. Like, each one comes with its own set of things you can do and can't do as well. And I think there's definitely no right answer, because I think some people would prefer the strategic adjustments that come with people perceiving you as a strong player. Like, there are definitely strengths there, but I personally prefer people perceiving me as weak. I feel like I know how to use that in more ways. But yeah,
I think I'm the same. I mean, we mentioned Phil Hellmuth and Andy Black earlier, and I think they both benefit from people perceiving them as very strong players, while conversely wanting to play against them, which is a weird phenomenon.
It's a good combo.
Yeah, it's a really good combo where the worst players at the table want to play against you because they want to go home and tell their friends that they beat Andy or Phil in a hand.
And some people will just give you their chips because they're like, I got to play with Phil Hellmuth.
Yeah. I played this huge hand against Phil, and I tried to bluff him, and I spoke to him at the end, and I told him he should fold. He still didn't fold. People want a good story, which is fine too. Like, you know, not everybody's motivation in poker is to make as much money as possible from poker. You have to respect other people's motivations.
Totally. They're not chumps. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lady I played with a lot in the early casinos. Wonderful older lady, Vera Duffy. And she was referred to as the bubble girl because she used to bubble tournaments a lot. And I remember one of the younger players saying to me, like, she's obviously a very smart lady. Why doesn't she just adjust her strategy? I said, I think her strategy is perfect for what she wants. The money doesn't mean anything to her. She's independently wealthy. Any amount of money she wins in here isn't going to make any difference to her life. And she was incredibly generous when she played cash. She often, when she was playing cash, she'd play the very last hand. And if she won it, she'd give her entire stack as a tip to the dealer. So the money clearly meant nothing to her, but she loved the sort of social aspect of the game and just being around. So she was optimizing for time in the tournament. That was her perspective. She didn't want to bust early and have to go home. Even, you know, as the bubble was looming, she didn't want to bust before the bubble. So if she got to the bubble and bust, that was better for her than, you know, busting earlier. Whereas for somebody like me, it would be the same outcome. In fact, I'd prefer to bust earlier because I get to go home earlier. But you kind of have to understand different people have different motivations, and they will generally optimize for what they're trying to get. And if, you know, if you're a strategically bad player and you find yourself playing against Phil Hellmuth, well, then maybe the best option for you is to go out in a blaze of glory against Phil. And then you have a story that you can tell all your friends back home.
Just, I'd say spread it around to other people too. You know, Phil's getting enough loose action. That's all. Yeah. If you're listening to this, just give it to Dara, give it to somebody else.
Yes, it is infuriating. Phil doesn't need it point.
Stop handing him the chips. All right. Well, thanks, Dara. This has been a great talk, and appreciate your time.
Thanks, Zach. It's been, I really enjoyed it as well.
That was Dara O'Kearney. You can follow him on Twitter at Dara O'Kearney. That's D-A-R-A, his first name. And if you're interested in poker, you can listen to his poker podcast, The Chip Race. If you like this interview, you might like checking out an interview I did with high stakes player Brian Rast. That's on my Reading Poker Tells YouTube channel. Also, if you're interested in Poker Tells, check out my readingpokertells.com site. If you're kind of interested in poker, but more interested in general psychology, I'd recommend my Verbal Poker Tells book. I've had people tell me that it improved their listening and interpretation skills, even outside of poker. You can learn more about this podcast at behavior-podcast.com. If you like this podcast, I appreciate shares on social media, and a rating on iTunes is also hugely appreciated. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.